Hey everybody, this is Brett. Today's April 6th. Welcome back to the show. Hot dog, what a week it has been. I just returned last night from Connecticut. Did you know that I was in four states yesterday? Count them. Connecticut, Massachusetts, Vermont, and New Hampshire. That's what I call embracing multiculturalism. So as you heard me mention in the last show, I was debating going down to Connecticut to see Tom Woods at Yale University. Good news, I did it. And it was so worth the drive and the other dangers. I stopped on the way to see my great friends, Rich and Lisa. You know them from Tragedy and Hope. And we had lunch, and I got to spend some time with them the next day and see some awesome footage that Rich recently shot. Oh, I don't even want to tell you too much. You should listen to our deep ends when we do them, if you have access, because we talk more about some of this stuff there. But yeah, New Haven was absolutely amazing. It was kind of a bummer at first. It was rainy. And Tom and I were supposed to meet up around 4, but his travel plans changed a little bit and things were a little frantic before the event, so we weren't able to do it. But I went sightseeing. I went to a museum. You should follow me on Instagram. It's School Sucks Project on Instagram. And anytime you see a video there, take the 30 seconds to watch it. I try to make funny little videos for my Instagram followers, but I also posted a few pics from my trip, so you can check them out there. So I get to the event in this beautiful old part of the campus, and I had no idea what we were... I didn't know what kind of event it was. I thought maybe Tom was just coming to speak. I know the topic was secession. I was real excited about the possibility of getting some footage of like a really sweet anti-Tom Woods protest. And I'm sorry, we're going to talk about this in the show today, but I underestimated Yale because in my mind, I'm picturing what this protest will be. Will it be like that time on YouTube where the girls stood up and smeared fake blood on themselves? Will they pull the fire alarm? Might I even get the chance to enjoy a hey, hey, ho, ho, Tom Woods has got to go kind of thing? But despite the high energy of this event, it was incredibly civil. It turns out that what we attended was the weekly meeting of the Yale Political Union. This is a debate society at the school. It was founded in 1934. It has been continuous since then. And it is the primary forum for both political discussion and activism at the school. It is the largest student organization at Yale. And you're going to hear me and Tom talk all about this in the show today. I got to meet or re-meet several School Sucks listeners. I wanted to do some quick shout outs to Mark, Phil, Zachary, and Nick. I also want to thank a listener named Wayne, who inadvertently helped me make the decision to go to Yale. Well, I was debating whether or not I wanted to go. I was checking my email, and Wayne sent me a $100 donation. And I said, gosh, you know, if I'm not too extravagant, that would probably pay for more than half the trip. So it was at that point that I decided to pack up my mobile recording studio and my toiletries, folks, because it was going to be an overnighter, and hit the road the next day. So thank you so much to Wayne. So anyway, the event was terrific. I met up with Tom afterwards. He was so nice. He took me out to dinner. He and I had a great unrecorded conversation. And then we walked across the campus and eventually got back to where he was staying. And we finally started our interview just after midnight. And that's what you get to hear on the show today. And I have to say, it was just a wonderful experience to be walking through this historic part of the Yale campus with Tom Woods, chuckling about the state of higher education today. It was a really special night. So thank you to all of you who listen to this show, because having an engaged and supportive audience gives me a reason to do these kinds of things and have these great experiences. Now, the interview was made technically possible by a listener named Darren Gill, who I've thanked on the show before, because about 3 years ago, he bought me an item off the Amazon wish list, the Zoom H4. And I just want to take this opportunity to say, even though none of you know Darren, congratulations, because Darren is about to marry his fiance, Micaiah. And I hope hearing this message cheers him up, because the poor guy broke his ankle at his own bachelor party about 3 weeks ago. Now, you might be saying, Brett, how do you know all this? Well, sorry, this is more like one of those small print items, but if you're curious, I'll let you know. When somebody buys something for us off the Amazon wish list, I have a team of people that work for me that do round-the-clock surveillance on them. But it's only for a period of 5 years, and it's nothing creepy. It's only for marketing purposes. We want to learn about the habits and the behaviors of the people who buy stuff on the Amazon wish list. So all that being said, congratulations to Darren, you know? And that's about it. I want to get right into this interview with Tom. Oh, man, I was so tired while we were doing this. It had been such a long day. So if you feel like anything wasn't developed as fully as it could have been, I'm sorry. This was between 12 and 1 a.m. after a very busy day. But I think you'll really enjoy the discussion anyway. So thank you so much for listening. Thanks to everybody who made this trip possible. I look forward to doing more of these things in the future. I've been out shopping for a new car. And once I have that, I'll actually be interested in driving again. I'm looking for something fun. You know what's really hard to find today is cars with manual transmissions. They don't seem to make them anymore. Even cars that clearly should be, you know, 5 or 6 speed. So that's what I'm looking for. You know, I like to shift. But yeah, if you have more ideas for in-person events, I did find out yesterday that Jordan Peterson is going to be at Harvard on Monday. But I just don't think I can do it. One doesn't just casually go into Boston. It's kind of like planning a mission to Mars. The Peterson event starts at 6:30. So you're talking about me driving into Boston during rush hour. It's the worst city to drive in, except for maybe like someplace in El Salvador where everybody is just driving around firing guns out their windows. But in the future, I'm happy to go places and attend events or speak at events. In fact, I was talking with one of the Yale political union organizers, a nice young man named Brian. And he expressed an interest in having me come down to speak at Yale on some education or school related topic. So I might take him up on that in the near future. All right, everybody. Here's Tom Woods. Thanks for listening and take care.
Like we always do with this time, I go for mine. I get to shine. And throw your hands up in the sky.
Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Let me just hear you say the first few letters of the alphabet.
Okay, A, B, C.
Okay, that looks perfect. Are you ready to begin?
I sure am.
All right. Tom, welcome back to School Sucks Podcast.
Glad to be here, Brett.
And thank you for trusting me in your hotel room past midnight.
It's just crazy sometimes what you wind up doing for this movement.
What a day, though. Let's set the scene. We are looking out a window here at the Yale University campus. You came here to speak about secession.
Yeah, I was invited by the Yale Political Union, and generally they want to speak about controversial stuff, and genuinely controversial stuff. I mean, it even passes my test, and I think most debates are pretty tame, but they talk about controversial stuff. So I picked secession. They told me I could choose a topic, not because it's the most radical thing I could talk about, but because it's a topic that I felt sure I would know more about than anybody in the room. And if I'm going to speak at Yale and in a debate setting, that's where I want to be on my strongest suit. So I think you'll agree with me, Brett. It was a highly unusual event. It goes on every single Tuesday night, though. They do this every week. It's amazing. And it was an event where I speak for 20 to 30 minutes, and then I take questions for about 15 minutes. And by the way, while I'm talking, people who agree with me are banging the seat, and people who don't agree are hissing. And this is what they do to everybody. They do it to each other. Then after the questions, individual students come up, and they have prepared statements. They have students from 7 different parties at Yale, the party of the right, the conservative party, the party of the left, the liberal party. They got all these different parties. And they got people from each of these. They come up. They give a statement. People ask them questions. People give rebuttals. It's totally crazy. And then meanwhile, I'm taking notes, and at the end, I get the final word. And it was just great. I mean, if I may say so, I gave a completely blistering final word where I responded to the various students, and I had fun. I did it in sort of a roast style. I really let them have it. When they were wrong, I let them know they were wrong. But everybody got along. It was all friendly. It was all in good fun. We all learned something. We talked about something controversial. Everything I just said just now, almost none of that ever happens at an American college. I have to hand it to Yale. That was a very impressive thing.
Well, as we were walking back from eating some dinner, I pointed out to you that the location of this event was right across the street from where that whole Halloween costume student yells at the professor. That was right across the street from this location. And I was saying to the organizer, Brian, afterwards, I'm so impressed with what I saw here tonight, because so many of us are outsiders and we've developed this kind of caricature of not just Yale, but of academia in general, that this kind of thing doesn't happen there. And as I mentioned this to you before, you said, don't make that the new rule. This was rare.
Yeah, we don't want to go the other extreme and say, oh, I guess universities are better than we thought. Only Yale is better than we thought. I have never seen a university that puts on an event like this, much less every single week, week in and week out, and they are going to be having other Misesian-style libertarians as speakers coming up soon. So they've got Jill Stein coming, they've got Bobby Jindal coming, people from all over the spectrum to talk about all different things, and it was just a blast, and it was wonderful. I got to meet a whole bunch of Yale students who listened to the Tom Woods Show. How about that?
Completely. I said I wanted to talk about your new book, Sane Space. That was probably inspired by the opposite of what we saw tonight to a large degree, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I have been doing a lot of writing about what goes on in college campuses because for some reason it just, I don't know why that of all things really sets me off. That and mass murder, those are the two things
right.
that get me really upset. And I realized that in the daily email newsletter that I send out, and when I say daily, it's sort of in quotation marks, because on a day like today, there was no way I was going to be able to get a newsletter out. I was here at Yale and it was just crazy. But all the same, I noticed there was a theme in a lot of what I'd been writing, which was, it's just unbelievable what goes on the campuses, and in particular, the attitude among some students that really it's impossible to have a different view from the one they have, that only people of bad will could have a view other than the one they have. So they have absolutely no incentive for any introspection whatsoever. Why bother? Because they can't possibly be wrong. And it's just such a depressing attitude. And what I like is, I like doing the opposite of what these people want. These people want their safe space. I like, to the contrary, to be debating or talking about things that everybody assumes were settled years ago. I like to rip them back open again, to discombobulate these people, get them off balance, make them think even things they once thought were sacred and cherished are now being questioned once again. Like the idea of secession. Well, that was decided 150 years ago.
Sure.
Not so fast, buddy. Woods is here to talk about it again. I like to just rip, you know, just tear things open again. But yeah, so I put together a little ebook for free where I share some of my thoughts or and sometimes it's fun. Sometimes I have a good time getting back to these people. But also there's some good, decent information in there too that you can use if you're ever in the unfortunate situation of finding yourself up against one of these people.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've felt a lot of my attention going that way too, towards what's happening on college campuses. And one of the things that I'm interested in your thoughts on this as well, but one of the things I start to worry about is, like, am I doing this because this is just like automatically self-generating comedy and it's so easy to line up against so much of what we're seeing? It's so ridiculous. What, have you explored your attraction or other people's attraction to it at all?
To some degree, I suppose there is the element of this is such an easy news item to report on.
Yeah,
you know, and it's going on everywhere and it's easy to find sources that will give you stories about this stuff. But for me, the main reason is my worry of what happens to American society when the sort of people who pull stunts like we see on the campuses are in charge of everything. And when everybody else has been taught to be cowed into silence by these people. That's why I generally support provocateur type speakers, even if I don't always agree with them, simply because this pattern where the social justice warrior left, they all get their way and people are just intimidated into silence, is a very bad model that I do not want to see replicated in society at large.
Well, we need these institutions, I think, still, because a lot of important work, a lot of important research is done in these institutions. And what I've noticed happening in the last couple of years is this agenda, it doesn't seem to have a finish line, right? It doesn't seem to have a destination. I was talking to a student named Sam, who goes to Vanderbilt, and he's the soon-to-be president of the College Republicans there. And I was asking him to, you know, tell me a little bit about campus life on a recent show. And I said, I don't think you shutting up, you being polite, giving these people what they want is any kind of a solution, because I think there's always another step. But the slippery slope was a logical fallacy before these people basically seemed to turn it into a tactic.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I've thought the same thing, by the way, about you can't imagine a point at which this sort of person says, okay, society is just the way I want it. Mm-hmm. Everything's fine. They're looking for forms of oppression that you need a microscope to see.
Right.
You think of genuine, actual oppression as it exists in the world, and then you compare it to where these people are finding oppression. It's a caricature. It diminishes what real oppression really is. We should be using an altogether different word to describe it. So, and by the way, you know, I graduated from college in 1994, and we had craziness on the campuses, but it wasn't like this, and it certainly wasn't. It wasn't to the point where everybody was just in sheer terror. They better not say the wrong thing, or they are not a member of the human race anymore. I mean, there was a little bit of that, but it wasn't just this suffocating, overwhelming feeling. And this is why it was so interesting to be at this Yale event tonight, because we were all, you know, talking about myself and people in the party of the right, were saying things that if you say them, you are evil, oppressive, racist, whatever, even though nothing we said had anything to do with race whatsoever, but obviously right. That doesn't matter to these people. And it's the sort of thing that you would be just shunned for, and yet everybody got along.
Outside of what we saw tonight, why do you think things are worse versus when you were in college in the 90s?
Honestly, I don't know what has happened. I can't make sense of how it's just gotten completely out of control. It seems to me like the numbers on the ground are the same. The professors are in the same proportion progressive as they were before. I guess the difference is that progressivism never stands still in the same way that, you know, we were
true.
Saying these people never get to a point where they say, okay, everything's fine. It never stands still. And as they have to look for ever, ever narrower forms of oppression, it seems like they get more shrill as the source of the oppression gets more small. As they should be getting happier, they get angrier in the same proportion. I can't make sense of it.
Yeah, that's interesting. You've had Jonathan Haidt on your show, I think, a couple of times, and I thought you guys had some really, really good discussions about some of the phenomenon. I mean, I think about what we see so much showing up on YouTube or in social media with a lot of this identity politics and campus activism. It seems to be like a confluence of factors running together. I absolutely agree with what you're saying about, you know, progressive, you know, it's a long march, continuous march forward. That's an aspect of it. But you know, I think there's some interesting generational considerations, and I think the technology of today allows for people, if they want to, be more insular, more shielded, more in their own echo chamber. You know, one of the things that I like about the left is it's kind of an instructive mirror for libertarians, for the libertarian movement. Their mistakes are so glaring. You know, like lots of libertarians have their vision of a utopian society. Well, these people do too. And if you get too fixated on that, I think the rest of the world really starts to look pretty crappy when you compare it to your utopia. And I've seen libertarians do it, and I've seen these leftists do it. And what it results in is alienation and resentment towards everything in the world. And it produces that kind of shrillness. And then there's you couple that with the insularity and just the challenges of being in this generation. It's no fault of their own, but they've never had to wait for anything. You remember waiting in a line at Blockbuster Video to rent a movie? You know, they don't. They never had that, like, delay of gratification. So it's like, I really see it as like a confluence of things coming together to produce this.
And then you add that together with the fact that it is very, it can feel very satisfying to portray yourself and think of yourself as being morally superior to other people. And this kind of progressivism gives people ample opportunity to do that. I'm better than you because I hold this view and you hold that view. I'm better than you because I see oppression and this, that, or the other thing. And everybody else is backward and stupid and oppressive and evil and wicked. And that becomes like a drug. Like, you need more of that. I need this feeling of superiority. So it's a very twisted, very unfortunate thing to get caught up in. And I know not everybody on the left goes quite this far, but certainly they don't do enough to speak out against this sort of people. But as I say, you know, I'm totally zonked and exhausted after it, but I'm still kind of in this brief, temporary, all too temporary feeling of, well, I was just a part of something tonight that if I were to just go by what YouTube tells me, this should be impossible.
Yeah.
That we actually had a civil discussion about a controversial thing, and everybody afterwards shook hands and said it was a great time. I don't see why that's so rare to the point where I've never seen it happen anywhere else.
You know, you were talking before, I do want to say more about the event tonight, but you're talking about this moral superiority that these leftists seek. You know, I have to say, as somebody who came from the left, I think, like, looking back at it and able to kind of reflect on my past, honestly, that was a big part of what attracted me to libertarianism. Like, the left is very much about shame, right? And shaming people like, oh, don't you know about what Howard Zinn said here? And how can you have your head buried in the sand? And all these things. But if you want really good shame tools, I mean, the non-aggression principle, you know, and that
everybody's guilty.
It was an easy transition to come from the left to, once you hear these arguments, like, these are way better. These are way more powerful tools than the left has a lot of tools.
But you know what's interesting, though? The difference there is that for most of us anyway, let's say the less obnoxious among us.
Yeah.
We realize that, or our point is generally that deep down, a lot of people get the basic idea of the non-aggression principle, and they live their lives according to it without really ever articulating it fully. And our point is simply that what they've missed is that there is another part of their lives, namely the part that involves politics, in which they are regularly abandoning this principle that they accept in every other aspect of their lives. And so our view is that, you know, largely through no fault of their own, they've just got this bifurcated mind where, on the one hand, they believe in non-aggression, but on the other hand, when it comes to politics, they don't. And we simply just want to bring to their attention this contradiction and try and resolve it for them. So we don't have this view that you are a reprobate and you can never be reached. It's more a question of, let's draw out, maybe Socratically, what it is that you already believe, what we already share in common, and I just want to show you that you should extend that farther. I think there's something that's inherently friendlier and less confrontational about our shame tools, as you call them, you know, than these other ones.
No, I agree. And I think it was, you learn how to wield them more responsibly and more gently and more compassionately the longer you have these beliefs. When all this stuff is new, it's like, look out. I poison so many wells with people on political topics, just being a new libertarian, that I would walk into a room and I would hear people change the subject because they would do that because they didn't want to have the conversation with me because they felt like I was so abrasive and so pedantic about it and so sure that I was, you know, right and superior to them. So, like I said, you know, I think there's lots of mirrors in the left as we look for better ways to take our ideas and communicate them in a reasonable way, in a way that's going to reach other people. I like to watch these people, not because I think it's hilarious and fun or low-hanging fruit, but I see a lot of myself in that mindset. I hate to say it. I hate to admit it.
Yeah, I get that. And let me add something that I've said before. It's not the case that if you are really aggressive with people, that necessarily always fails.
Because
sometimes you get them thinking and they get frustrated because they can't really answer you and you're being so insistent. And sometimes that plants a seed with people. Like in my case, I didn't become a libertarian or I started off as being like an anti-war conservative and then I became a libertarian. And I didn't become those things because somebody sat me down and said, "Now, Tom, let me show how your principles contradict the things you're support." No, I was told, look, you're supporting morally outrageous things. You should be ashamed of yourself and look at the reality of the situation. And you're just repeating ridiculous conservative talking points that bear no connection to reality. Wake up. You're abandoning the principles that you say you believe in. Like, it was people who did the rhetorical equivalent of grabbing me by the collar and shaking me.
Yeah.
And so that's why I don't reproach myself for being tough with people sometimes, because sometimes people will say, "Well, Woods, you got to be a little bit kinder." Well, okay, some people need kindness, and they need a massage and strawberries and cream or whatever, and maybe some people can give them that, and some of my stuff will give them that, but I know for a fact, because I was one of them, that some people need to be, you know, smacked in the head rhetorically.
I totally agree. And I think there needs to be a kind of division of labor with that, right? Like, different people have different kinds of communication styles, and there's no right answer. Like, there's lots of people out there that I think we could connect with who we haven't connected yet, but there is certainly not one way to do it. You know, I bet your approach does. I've tried to look for that softer approach, but I honestly can't say how effective it's been.
Yeah. And the thing is that you really can't know in the long run.
That's true, yeah.
Always how many people you've influenced, because maybe you influence somebody who comes to agree with you 10 years later. In fact, I remember being in college, and I was a freshman, and I was debating a guy, he was an American who had moved to Egypt at age 5 because his father was a diplomat. But he was American, but he was basically Egyptian culturally. And he did not at all support, this was the 1990 going into 1991, this was the Operation Desert Storm, the first Iraq war. And I was all in favor of it. Why? Because I was a Republican and the Republicans were in favor of it. And
right,
so
right.
I went along and I found the arguments in favor and I supported them. And he was just telling me every which way how wrong I was. And we just he just couldn't get over how wrong I was. And I just thought he was some dopey idiot. And then years later, I thought, you know, geez, and I just the world just no longer seemed to conform to my talking points. And I thought, doggone it, that guy was right. And I never had an opportunity to see him again. And then one day I was walking down the street in Boston and I just ran into him at random. And I said, look, it's great to see you and everything, but I need to tell you something. You were totally right about the foreign policy stuff. You were completely right. I was completely wrong, and I can't tell you how satisfying it is to see you in person and be able to tell you that. And he never sugarcoated it with it. He would say, "Man, come on now. Look at these atrocities you're supporting. Man, you're better than that. Man, come on now." And, you know, and he wasn't writing me. He wasn't delivering beautiful soliloquies and writing me sonnets. He was hitting me over the head.
Right.
But again, how could he have known? He would never even have known that any of that did any good if I hadn't just purely at random of all the millions of people who could have been walking down that street, I just happened to see him and told him. You know, and it's the same principle, by the way, for that English teacher you had in ninth grade, you know, who assigned you Sinclair Lewis that you didn't really read. You read the Cliff Notes and that was the end of it.
Right.
And then you see him years later. You got to tell that teacher, listen, you know, I grew up and later on I went ahead and I read that Sinclair Lewis book and it really wasn't half bad.
Right.
So it wasn't totally wasted on me. People do appreciate that, you know.
Sure. You know, you wrote an email a few months ago and I read it in one of my shows. It was about talking to the left.
Oh, yeah. I got in trouble for that.
This was actually a really controversial thing on my show. And what I said at the time when I first read it, it was in part one of a series I did called Speed in Politics, which was trying to explain the post-election hysteria through like a psychological lens. And I said, well, you know, I came from the left and I'm glad people were willing to talk to me. 3 months later, I said, you know what? Tom Woods was right. I said, because of the very thing that I talked about with this generation, people are too quick and too deep in their own battle stations now. Right. So it becomes very, very hard. And we can see this in all of these, instances on college campuses. And the only thing that I would change, the only thing that I would want elaborated out of that is what do we mean by the left? Because I think most people, because we live in a society where, you know, public school runs to the left, mainstream media, mainstream news runs to the left, Hollywood runs to the left, Google, Facebook, all of these institutions that are so important in people's lives lean to the left. And because public school produces minds that are generally apathetic when it comes to politics, most people just grow up and they drift to the left without really thinking about it. I had some conversation about funding for the arts with somebody who I had always thought, who I'd never talked about with politics with before, and I had always thought she was totally reasonable until we had this conversation. She was like, well, yeah, funding for the arts, right? I said, no funding for the arts. But that was just the result of never really thinking about these things. So there are a lot of people, my point is that they're casually on the left. You know, they're not these
crazy. Yeah, you know, those people you can talk to.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the people, their whole identity is wrapped up in being on the left.
Sure.
Almost none of them can be talked to. Now, again, there are exceptions. I had Ralph Nader on my show, and it was perfectly pleasant. It was fine. It was wonderful. I mean, partly because we hate the same people. I mean, that's a great conversation starter. But I'm talking about people. See, the difference between left and right, and no, I don't believe people who say there's no such thing as left and right. Yes, there is. So I don't agree with you. But the difference is the left has these words they can use against you that can destroy your career and your life. If they call you a racist or a whatever else they could call it. Now white supremacist is the new term for racist because that one got old. Nobody believes it anymore because they use it all the time. So now it's white supremacist. So that's the new word. But, you know, and then there's sexism and everybody's a bigot or they're a this-a-phobe or that-a-phobe. Now, the right wing, they sometimes use anti-Semite against people. The left does that too. But by and large, it's really the left has these words that they can use, and they poison conversations with them. The right doesn't have that. They pathetically try to call the left bigots because they're anti-Christian. That just rolls right off them.
Yeah.
There's no leftist who thinks, oh my goodness, my job's at stake because I'm a Christophobe. You know, that,
right.
No one feels that way. That's what I mean, that it's hard to talk to them because they're so ready to use words and like this that they think end the discussion. And instead, these words are a substitute for discussion. And that's what I mean about how frustrating it is and why I personally think I could convert 10, 15 people on the right over in the time it would take me to even get a word in edgewise with somebody on the left. So, yeah, I mean, if you have that kind of spare time and that kind of unique talent, then be my guest. You know, I was on my show recently. I pointed out that maybe he listens to your show, but there is a drama queen on Facebook. I probably shouldn't mention his name, who got all dramatic that I had said this about the left. And he's all weeping tears about how he was on the left, and it's a good thing the libertarian movement wasn't all full of Tom Woodses, because this way, you know.
I wonder if that's my friend, who's very bombastic online, by the way. Yeah, and I was joking with him because he's more of a left libertarian, but like sort of just around the bend. And we've done a lot of shows together. And I said, you know, I was going through his wall looking for something because we were going to talk about it on a show. And I was like, we have to do a series called Explain Your Post, you know, because some of your posts are just like, what is.
Well, this was like F this and F that and F Tom Woods and whatever. I thought, gee, I mean, first of all, like just this whole thing of I've got to proclaim to the world my reaction to. My response to that is, number one, it's people on the left themselves who come to me and say, Woods, your only problem is you're not tough enough on these people. I know because I used to be one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and by the way, you think I haven't been tough on – you know what I used to be? I was a neocon. You think I haven't been tough on the neocons? I wrote a whole book, almost a whole – I mean, my book, Real Dissent, is almost entirely on the neocons. And if anything, I am much more vicious on the neocons. So I'm much more vicious on my former self. And I didn't then write myself a letter saying, well, good thing I didn't have to come in contact with Tom Woods or I would never have converted. No, it's because I know how rotten these people are that I'm as tough as I am with them.
Yeah. Maybe he was just using the name Tom Woods. And maybe I'm entirely responsible for this because I read your email on my show once.
Yeah, maybe so.
Maybe Tom Woods was just kind of embodying this idea that is kind of what I see as being part of the problem, is that people go to their battle stations and they don't talk anymore. And like, there is something that is a little bit unattractive about saying, I'm not going to talk to these, because there's a lot of this in New Hampshire, right? There are a lot of the free staters, they don't talk to normal people.
Right.
And, you know, not talking, as you've pointed out, with these people who shut down these discussions on the left leads to more aggressive types of interactions. So
right.
I think it might be a kind of warning to say, well, let's delegate somebody to talk to these people.
Yeah, and that's fine. The thing is that it can't be me because although I have brought some people over from the left without particularly trying, just by doing my regular thing, the problem is, as I say, because the left is addicted now to this language, this demonizing language that just ends and shuts down productive discussion, why is this something I would want to pursue? I mean, I'm going to have my name dragged through the mud if I'm going to debate these people. Forget it. You know, at least the conservatives, for all their faults and all the terrible policies they support, they don't do that to me. I can talk to them and it's not like within 5 seconds they say, wait a minute, are you a racist? I read three sentences you wrote 25 years ago and who acts like that? That is not normal. That is not how human beings ought to be interacting with each other. These people are decent to me. They listen to what I have to say, and some of them change their minds. So that's where I'm coming from. I'm upset that I can't even have conversations with people who all they want to do is demonize. And if you're going to pretend that's not happening on the left, you've got to be kidding me.
Yeah, well, no one should be pretending this. I mean, they're the worst at that, absolutely. Now, with this more casual left, this person who's just kind of been, to a certain extent, a victim is a strong word, but they've been kind of a casualty of a left-leaning culture and a public school system that made them sort of politically and philosophically apathetic. So they've drifted into this place. They really don't know why they're there. They say things like, cause FDR, you know, that's a reason. If you could take one piece of your work, whether it was a podcast that you can think of off the top of your head or a book or an article, and give to people like that? Because I bet there's a lot of people in my audience who'd have that question. If I could take one thing and give it to this person who's just casually wandered over there to ignite their interest in this topic and persuade them quickly, is there something that you've done that comes to mind for that kind of person?
Yeah, I'll have to look up the episode numbers. There are two episodes of my show that are really just recordings of speeches that I've given.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was like a speech I gave at the Mises Institute to a group of high schoolers and homeschoolers who had come for a one-day seminar. And I basically said, here's the half-hour speech I would give to the whole world if I had their attention about why the free market matters. So that's one. I guess there's also one. There's one I gave to the Texas Libertarian Party, and it was called The Libertarian Speech I Would Deliver to the Whole World. That one's on YouTube. Then the other one is, I think this is the best speech I've ever given. And I remember Judge Napolitano was in the audience, and it just gave me such satisfaction that it went over so well, that it really, I delivered it so well, because he loved it too. And it's called Four Things the State Is Not. Because we have, and I actually don't even remember what all four of them are, because the state isn't those things, so I've forgotten. But one of them is, you know, the state is not this dispassionate public service agency
right.
that has no interests of its own, that's just dispassionately looking after your own good. It is anything in the world but that. And so I go through and give examples, because these are the sorts of things that, as you say, a casual person who's not giving this a lot of thought, they would think that, right? Well, these are my elected officials, and they're trying to do what's best for me and provide for the common good. And I just go through and just give example after example. This is not the way you should think about it. And that's, I think, because it addresses the way somebody might by default think, I think it's the most effective thing I've ever done in terms of public speaking.
Yeah, and I think there's a real need for that. Because, I mean, do you agree that most people are that? They're just people who, you know, they wander in front of a TV, CNN is on, MSNBC is on, they kind of interface with current events through headlines that come up in their Facebook news feed. I'm getting like political messages from Windows 10, you know, like the news stories that it's feeding me are all very like agenda driven, anti-Trump, I find. I don't have like political spectrum settings on there. Those are just the stories that, you know, Microsoft Edge feeds me through Windows 10. So it's understandable how people wind up in this position.
Oh, yeah.
And it's most people.
And it's not even, I mean, it's also corporate America very reliably repeats left-wing talking points. My favorite recent example was Audi did a video about the gender pay gap.
Yeah.
And of course I've done stuff on the gender pay gap. I don't believe in any of that stuff, but they did this video and then somebody pointed out, well, let's see, what are women earning at Audi and what are men earning at your very company? And can you believe the response they gave was, well, when you factor in the differences in what women and men do at Audi, you'll see why that, yeah, that's the explanation everywhere.
Yeah.
That's the same explanation 3 seconds ago you weren't willing to accept from any other private employer. But all of a sudden, when the spotlight is on you, that's the excuse you're going to give. They were utterly demolished, which is great, but most people only see the propaganda. They never get to see the demolition.
And why is there that pandering? Because the corporation is obviously going to be the friend of people on the right, so they have to pander to people on the left?
I think it is that. I think the corporation feels like it gets a bad rap from people on the left, and people on the right, they're going to win over anyway because they're corporations. I think that's the way they think. So we might as well do the outreach to the people we need to do the outreach to. I think there is some of that.
Absolutely. So look, I'm exhausted and I'm going to get out of here in a minute. Last question.
Okay.
Favorite part of the night? What was the best thing that you saw there at Yale?
Okay. Well, I mean, I hope we're able to get video. The mics weren't working. Who knows? They say the audio came out reasonably okay, but my favorite moment was after I had spoken, I had taken questions, and then student after student after student came up and spoke, and some were for me and some were against me, and some weren't quite sure. But I was taking notes through the whole thing, and then they give me some time to respond. And I feel like the response part was my strongest part of the night, because I addressed people who were just – it wasn't just a matter of opinion. They made assertions that were incorrect. It was great to not just enjoy ourselves and not just marvel at how wonderful it is that we could all be civil while debating something controversial. It was also nice to have the satisfaction of knowing, yeah, I smashed this out of the park, and that feels darn good to do that at Yale University.
Yeah, it was really amazing. I mean, the first part where you get up there and you spoke probably for about 20 minutes, and then you sit down, and I say, this guy got on a plane for that? Is that it? Is that all that's going to happen? I knew there'd be some Q&A.
Right.
But I was totally blindsided by – I'm not an Ivy Leaguer myself, so I had never seen this kind of discussion format.
And I didn't know exactly the format either.
Right, right. So I guess they've been doing this since the 1930s.
Yeah, this is really old, and they do it every single Tuesday. But then the closing statement made the whole thing worthwhile to me. I was so glad to be able to do that. And I did it in a kind of roast style at the beginning, because I got up and I said, well, you know, Brian such and such is a guy who really made all the arrangements and my transportation. So, you know, you'd think I'd be a little bit more charitable than to get up here and demolish his terrible arguments, but I have to. You know, it was that kind of talk,
yeah.
And everybody loved it and laughed, and it was great.
And then you did some just meet and greet with people afterwards, and there was a guy, he went up there, and I thought he was acting. And then he came up to you after. He goes, oh, no, I'm a total neocon. I helped Donald Rumsfeld write a book.
Yeah,
and then you guys had a back and forth, a continuation. Like, he seemed like he had more he wanted to say to you.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. This was an interesting guy who I actually said in my closing thing, I thought he had made the most intelligent comments of the night.
Yeah.
And he was very flattered by that. But he said, look, you are looking at a Washington neocon in the flesh. And I thought, shudder. but we did, you know, we had a pleasant enough chat. But when he told me that, you know, the type of person he'd go see speak is Donald Rumsfeld, I just thought, oh, my goodness, I don't even know where to begin with you. But you're right. It was wonderful. I had a lot of supporters in the audience from Yale and not from Yale. And I had a couple who had driven from Virginia to come up and support me. I mean, and people had driven from Boston. I mean, you know, you came in from New Hampshire, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So, I mean, this is that's amazing.
Yeah, I had some of my audience here too that I got to meet for the first time.
Yeah, isn't that great? Yeah, yeah. I saw. Yeah, you were talking to people like you had known them forever, and you just met them tonight.
I did. It was very, very cool. So, what's next for you?
Other than going to bed because it's 1 a.m.
Exactly.
I got up at 7 this morning, which for me is extremely early. Well, I have a couple of little things that I'm finishing. My friend Mark Thornton is coming out with a book on some of the great work he's done. He's such a great economist, and I'm writing the foreword to that. With me right now, I'm pretty much kind of content with how things are going. Later this year, I will be hitting episode 1,000 of the Tom Woods Show. So I'm looking to – I'd like to arrange a live in-person event for episode 1,000. Make this big and have some fun with it. So I have to figure that out. I mean, would people come to that? I don't know. I would be inclined to do it in Florida because that's where I'm living now. I'll probably keep putting out the old – you know, I put out free ebooks a lot. I'll keep doing that. And – there's a decent likelihood that in the next year or so, I'll be doing co-authoring a book on the war on terror that basically refutes it systematically, then just shows that there are no grounds on which you can support this. It fails indeed, on every conceivable ground you could possibly defend it on. So that one, even though I don't really have much desire to write any more books, I mean, they drain me in every way, physically and mentally. But this one, I just feel morally compelled to do. And yeah, there have been books attacking this or that part of it, but I want systematic. I want every country that's been involved with it, I want to talk about and smack it down. So that'll be another project. But basically, I'm just going to do more of the same. I like doing my podcast. I like doing Contra Krugman. I like doing the cruise that I do every year with Bob Murphy. I like doing my online entrepreneurship stuff. I do a lot of stuff that keeps me busy, just staying up with my regular stuff. So adding anything extra onto that, it's making me tired just thinking about it.
Well, the two times that I was on your show, I noticed that you were concerned about how many episodes I had compared to you. And I'm you'll be happy to learn that this year you will double me.
Wow.
After I think you – when did you start the show?
September 2013.
Okay. So, and you started years after I did.
But I mean, I'm doing it 5 times a week. That's crazy.
No,
that's not normal.
So if I have you in the room, and I don't ask you this before I leave, my listeners will egg my house. Do you have some kind of method to your productivity? Is there some kind of secret formula that Tom Woods has? Because you do. I mean, you get a ton of stuff done.
You know, I actually did an episode called something like My Productivity Secret or something like that.
Yeah.
And that was probably the only clickbaity title I've ever really used. Because my titles, they might be provocative, but I deliver on them.
Yeah.
This one was clickbaity because when you listen to it, it turns out my productivity secret is work yourself to exhaustion, sacrifice everything that's dear to you, make yourself miserable, and don't sleep. That's my secret. So when you hear that, you say, well, I'm not even sure I wanted to know that. So I will say that I have recovered from that. I'm not in that mode any longer. But now I look at what I do, and I honestly don't feel like I do that much. I mean, yeah, I do an episode a day, but the episode is between a half an hour and an hour.
Yeah.
Compare that to a guy doing roofing in 100-degree Alabama heat, and I got it made. I mean, I put out an occasional ebook, but I mean, the thing is, with me, it's just that I've gotten able to, because I've done this for so long, I can do things fast. I can write fast. I can write a daily email newsletter really quickly. And in fact, I have two different email lists. I have one on libertarianism, and I have one on earning money online, which is about as difficult as falling off a log, as my friend Ben Settle says.
Yep.
So I wanted to, I feel like people are just letting opportunities pass them by constantly. So I'm constantly sharing with people, this is what I do, here's another thing I found, now I'm doing this, and whatever. I remember, by the way, I know this isn't what you asked me, but there's a guy named Pat Flynn who has a Smart Passive Income podcast.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah. And when I saw how Pat Flynn was earning his money, and I realized he was earning $40,000 per month as an affiliate of Bluehost web hosting, my first thought was, I'm getting a piece of that. There ain't no way I am not getting a piece of that. So I developed a thing where if you use my affiliate link, I give you four unbelievably helpful bonuses that will give you free traffic and all kinds of stuff from me. And so everybody wants that. Who wouldn't? And then I get a commission. So I'm interested in stuff like that. I know some people aren't. I don't understand why they're not, because that's like the easiest money I possibly earn.
Sure.
It takes me 3 seconds to do the thing I need to do, and I earn a commission for that. Like, why would I not want to? So I have an email list dedicated to that too, and I do that every day. But I just enjoy it so much. It just, it goes quickly. I can do it really fast. And then if I do anything above and beyond that these days, I'm not killing myself. I'm not saying, well, this has got to be done by April 12th or whatever. I do my regular stuff every day, and if there's time left over, I work on a little outside project here and there. But I used to just kill myself with self-imposed deadlines. Or what I would do – here's some perverse thing that I used to do, Brett. I would have three deadlines, and I would deliberately do the one that was farther out first because I knew that I would get them all done one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
But I would just make it as hard on myself as possible, so that when the really urgent one comes up, I really got it. I mean, I just the things I was doing to myself, like I would add stuff to my plate because I knew I would never say to somebody, "I'm sorry, I can't deliver." I knew I would always do it, so it would just be a question of let's see how I can get it done. Let's see how. This is not possible, but since I've committed to it, I know it'll get done. Let's see how I wind up doing it. I mean, it was perverse. I mean, if you're a workaholic, you're a sick, twisted bastard. And that really is what becomes of you. And now it's just a matter of I do my regular thing. I'm in a routine. You get into a routine. You get good at something. You can produce a lot quickly. And then, if I say, if I have a little spare time, I work on something else. If not, not.
When you were pushing yourself like that, did you have this, Tom, like this state in mind? Like, this is what I'm working towards, or this is what I imagine I'm working towards?
At the beginning, no. It was, I always kind of envisioned myself as constantly working.
You thought there'd be no end to it.
Yeah, I kind of did. I thought there'd be no end to it. But I thought this is how I thrive, you know, is by work and by, you know, constantly proving myself or whatever. Because ever since I've been in like middle school, I always felt like I had to prove myself because I was the dorky kid and
sure. People
didn't want to hang around with me and they didn't realize how funny I was, right? I'm kind of funny. Why don't you want to hang around with
me?
So I had to prove myself in that way. And I was, you know, and then I would always be insecure, even like now, like if people go to lunch, do they really want me to come along? Was I explicitly invited? I'm always doubting myself. So I would use productivity and work as a way to validate myself in my own eyes and other people's eyes. And you know, then I got to this when I did the Ron Paul curriculum and I did 400 history videos for that. And that was murder. It was the most impossible project in the history of the world. It took me 2 years of nonstop work. It was so much work, it crushed my spirit. And I actually began to think, you know, when this is over, I think I don't want to do this anymore. And so I don't push my – people always write to me. They say, Woods, you got to write a book on X, Y, or Z. And I feel like, you know, somebody else has to pick up the slack now.
Sure, yeah.
So now I've gone from I used to resent going on vacation to I am lovingly planning my vacations 6 months in advance.
Right.
I've gotten to where I need to be spiritually. Boy, this took a weird turn toward the end.
I think this is like one of the most important subjects in my audience, and this is one of those things that is not taught in school. productivity. And what is the approach? Is it this you know, grind yourself down so you can relax later? And there's sort of a stoic appeal to that, I guess, you know, that walking through the fire to get
You know, I guess there is one aspect of that I was trying to do, which was I wanted to get to a point where I wouldn't have to travel constantly to support the family. I'd be able to generate income from home doing the sorts of things that I do. And with stuff like affiliate marketing, which I do, and if I may be perfectly blunt, I am pretty darn good at, by the way. Mm-hmm. That has made it possible for me to have 10 times the lifestyle I used to have without running myself ragged flying all over the country. And it lets me do something I love doing, which is my podcast every day. So that's why I want to help people figure out how they can do what I'm doing, because it sure is making me happy.
Absolutely. So I didn't know about this other list you had. How do people get on that?
The best free ebook I've written. I wrote this from scratch. It's called Five Paths to an Online Income, and it shows the five different things that I do, like selling things as an affiliate. Like, I sell the Ron Paul curriculum as an affiliate. Mm-hmm. I sell Bluehost web hosting as an affiliate, and I show people exactly how to do that, how to do it effectively, how to get people to want to order from you and your link. But I've also self-published books and whatever. So I've got five different things that I've done, and I have all the experience in the world. I know exactly how to do it step by step. So if you feel like I don't even know where to begin, I wrote this ebook about it. And so you can pick that up at a website called pathstoincome.com. And the price of the ebook is you get on my email list. But it's a good email list. You won't want to you can easily unsubscribe from it, but you won't want to, because I want people on that list who get it, who are excited, who want to do stuff, you know, who want to figure out, hey, you know, I can make an extra $200 a week or something doing X or Y, optimizing my website, or, you know, doing this affiliate thing. Yeah, I want people who think that's awesome, because I think that's awesome.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's amazing how many different ways there are, like how many different places there are to look, right? To develop, I think to go from that scarcity mindset, which plagues so many of us, to being able to say, this is what I want, and this is, and finding the way to get it. Just if it means changing up a strategy, right? Maybe people say, I don't have this thing. Or maybe you just don't have the right strategy. Maybe that's what's in between you and that thing. It's not, you know, actually that you going and earning the money. It's you don't have the best plan, or you don't have the best approach to doing it.
Right.
All right. Now I'm truly exhausted.
Yeah. It's almost 1 a.m., which, I mean, 1 a.m. is not so bad, but given that I've got to be in a car heading to the airport at 6 a.m.
Exactly. And I've got to be in a car definitely by in 10 minutes. I really appreciate you making this possible. And I really, really enjoyed everything that I saw tonight. I thought that was a fantastic event. So thanks for being on the show, and thanks for coming up to New England.
Well, I'm so glad you made this drive all the way to come to the event. I was very glad to have you there. I was glad we had time to have dinner and talk and then sit in my hotel room until 1 in the morning recording a podcast episode. You know, these are the sorts of things that don't happen to me all the time. So
that's true.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Hey, everybody. Final note. If you want Tom's book, you can get it at sanespacebook.com. And if you enjoyed today's show, please consider supporting the School Sucks Project. We're still just short of our Patreon goal. There's links to support us on Patreon in the show notes. You can also go to Patreon, patreon.com/School Sucks. Or if you want access to, oh my goodness, literally hundreds of hours, figuratively billions of hours of additional School Sucks content, sign up to support us through the AV Club. It is schoolsucksproject.com/AV. Okay, I'll talk to you again soon.